All right. Josephus is the topic for tonight's forum. Maybe a little bit less volume because it's an intimate group. You like it? Okay. She likes it. We're good. So basically, before we jump right into who this guy was and what he is all about, I want to give sort of a 30,000-foot view of Scripture. This is something we covered a few weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, and I'm going to do a little bit of review for that. So if you were here last time, there will be a little bit of a review on that same topic, and it relates to what we're going to be talking about with Josephus very, very well. That's why I thought I would do a little bit of review there. If you weren't here, then it'll be brand new. So, and also, as I was preparing for Josephus, I realized that there's a lot to cover. So the next forum that we'll do will be Josephus Part 2. Because in my note preparation, I only got to a certain place that wasn't the end. It was just the beginning, really. So if look at the schedule here, next time we're going to meet is August 15th. Sorry, August 1st. So August 1st, this topic on there right now is sin in the Christian life. We're going to push that back later, and we're going to do Josephus Part 2 then. So we'll try and make as much headway as we can, and whatever we don't get to, we will address next time. All right, so let me pass out a sheet here. Let me get you to do me a favor, Elijah, and pass this out. Thank you. The particular document that I am handing out right now is basically kind of an overview of the structure of the entire history of the Old Testament seen through the lens of the Abrahamic promise. And when you take the Abrahamic promise, which is the very far column here going vertically down, it's basically all the various components of the Abrahamic promise. And that can be looked upon a couple of different ways. In terms of the actual land promise that God makes to Abraham, your offspring will face affliction for 400 years. They shall come back here to the fourth generation. To your offspring I give this land. So there's a land promise that is actually fulfilled with this is a promise that God makes to Abraham, and this is fulfilled as the people of Israel leave out and head to the promised land after the Exodus. So they are conquering the land with Joshua. This is the time of Moses is handing the baton to Joshua, and they are entering the promised land. So that is essentially a real fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise, but there are some echoes and parallels here that we find. For example, if you look at the next column, Exodus and Conquest, we have the initial promise of looking towards the heavens and seeing the stars. In Deuteronomy, we have that promise just before they enter the promised land. Whereas you were as numerous as the stars, if you don't fulfill the terms of the covenant under the Mosaic promise, the Mosaic covenant is a little bit different than the Abrahamic promise. In the Abrahamic promise, there aren't any, you must do this. It's just a promise, I will give. The Mosaic, it's do this and you'll be blessed. If you don't do this, you'll be cursed. And that's actually what Paul says in Galatians. It's given on top of the Abrahamic promise. It doesn't annul the previous covenant. But it's a similar theme that you will be as numerous as the stars, or you will be reduced to as few. You'll be very few in number. In the next column, the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. That sort of is a similar theme that we found in Genesis 15:13. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there, and I will bring you back again. So there's that idea of return. So Abraham returns, and the people are in Egypt for a while. He goes back to the promised land. So, and this is the same thing with the Exodus. Deuteronomy 28, If you will not obey, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. Exodus 23, I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Euphrates. This is something that I think we forget a lot. We think in terms of the Holy Land as basically the area around Jerusalem, maybe a little further north, and then you get too far north and you get to the Samaritan area. Well, actually, the original promise was from the river of Egypt, the Nile, to the Euphrates, Iraq. And that is a particular border that was promised to Abraham and then is mentioned here again in the time of Exodus, but this time with the Mosaic Covenant. Now, you start here, and then you move to the next level, to the time of David and his sons. In 2 Samuel, you know, you have this this promise that though David is going to build a house, God is actually going to build him a dynasty. The issue isn't important what the people do or build. The issue, the most important thing is what God is going to build. And then in 1 Kings, we find that 480 years after the Exodus, Solomon began building the temple. 480 years. That number gets very, very interesting when we compare it to what's going on in Daniel chapter 9. 1 Kings 8, when your people have sinned and have been defeated, hear them and listen and bring them back to this land. 1 Kings 21, Ahab acted as abominably as the Amorites, and they did abominations more evil than the Amorites did. So that theme of you will kick out the Amorites because the Amorites are occupying my holy land, and I'm calling you to be the eviction, to serve the eviction notice. Well, now we have, in this time, after the time of David, we have this eviction notice being given to God's holy people. They're not acting holy. They're acting more evil than the Amorites. Therefore, they need to be evicted themselves from the land. 2 Samuel 8, David conquers all the way to the Euphrates. Solomon ruled from the border of Egypt to the Euphrates. At some point, I want to show you guys a documentary that PBS put on, which talked about the mines of King Solomon. It had copper and gold. It's a PBS documentary. It's very interesting, but it does show that Solomon's reign was huge, and that it was much more significant than many of us think. And this particular text is accurate. Essentially, David and Solomon were the new Caesars, the new pharaohs of the region. They were the Nebuchadnezzar of their time period, the great king, and then you had tributary kings all throughout the region. But they were the great kings, and this was essentially the first earthly fulfillment of that Abrahamic promise that this area would be their territory and that they would rule it and other clients would have to bow to them. But the question was, is it an eternal kingdom? And that's what the Mosaic Covenant is meant to teach us, that based on our own abilities, we don't do very well. The kingdom that we're building ultimately will fail, but the kingdom that God builds will be a little bit differently. So then we have these two stages now to the beginning of the end. Once we have this recognition that the sons of David are beginning to fall, and it's getting very clear that David himself, you know, is spying on Bathsheba. Here's the one after God's own heart. Even the best that we can do is tainted. And so you have this particular place where it gets really, it's the zenith of God's people, the time in the land, and then it all goes downhill. So the beginning of the end is the Assyrian crisis, and this is what I want you to think about as you read Scripture. You have this this sort of the beginning of the end, and then finally the end, which is on the first level, the Babylonian captivity. And this is the first level. There is a second level we'll talk about. That is, the whole story sort of gets told, starts over again, and that's what we'll talk about with this second level chart. The beginning of the end here is the Assyrian crisis. So when you're reading the prophets, you want to think in terms of which area, which region, which time period is this prophet thinking about. If it's Isaiah, you know, he is talking about the Assyrian threat. But then he also will see further down the road to the Babylonian crisis. And if you know Isaiah, he also sees further than that to the return to the land and then the time of Christ. But many of the prophets just have that that sort of single focus, where they're actually only thinking of one single thing, the particular threat of their time period. All right, so the Assyrian threat. Isaiah 1, the daughter of Zion is like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field. Yet Jerusalem is rescued from Sennacherib later in Isaiah. And compare that to the Genesis 15, 5. Look toward the heavens, see the stars. Well, here, there's only one city left. And this particular city of Jerusalem is the one that's not besieged. And even that, you have this particular crisis where Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, is caging Hezekiah like a caged bird, and they're the only ones left that haven't fallen. Hosea 1:6, I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel. God will have mercy upon Judah. So Israel, Samaria area, is basically destroyed, but the only one left is Judah, and it is being threatened. Deuteronomy 4, we have this warning, when you are in tribulation in the latter days, you will return to the Lord and obey his voice. That is something that's not an if, it's a fact. When you do this, then you will have, you will return. And I believe, since there was a return after the exile, this is referring to the Babylonian captivity. Amos 2, Israel's transgression, I will not revoke the punishment, yet it was I who destroyed the Amorites from before them. So that theme of the Amorites comes up again echoing the themes of the Abrahamic promise. 2 Kings, Sennacherib's boastful words, surely you have heard what Assyria has done to all the countries of the world. So he, Sennacherib now, is the new Davidic king. He's the new emperor of the world, the one that the children of Israel were supposed to have. They left Pharaoh, and they were going to be the ones that ruled the world. But now it's under Sennacherib's care. Babylonian captivity, the last line here, total eviction. Nehemiah 9, you multiplied their children as the stars of heaven and brought them into the land. But since they rebelled, God gave them to the enemy. We find Solomon's temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of kings. Nebuchadnezzar is called the king of kings. Does that theme come up anywhere else in Scripture? Yeah, it does. This is actually one of the things you read in the Dead Sea Scrolls, is that many of the Jewish rabbis were expecting this messianic king that would be the new Caesar, and they actually thought of this king of kings, but they thought of it in terms of an earthly fulfillment, that the Romans would be vanquished, and then the new Jerusalem or Judean king would be the new king of kings, the new Caesar, an earthly kingdom. But Jesus, of course, said, my kingdom is not of this world. Daniel 9, we have sinned and acted wickedly, he prays. O Lord, hear and forgive us. Make your face shine upon your sanctuary. This is the returning theme. He is now, after the Babylonian captivity, looking back and asking for a return. Ezekiel, make known to Jerusalem her abominations. They have Canaanite origins. God says, your father was an Amorite and your mother was a Hittite. That Amorite theme comes up again here. You guys are worse than the pagans. The Amorites were called 500 years before it happened. The sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure, but their wrath is being stored up. And you guys are going to be called to kick them out. Well, again, this theme of you are worse than the Amorites has come back. All right, second stage is now that the people of God are humbled. So you read that the humble prayer that Daniel gives in Daniel 9, and it's very, very humble that we have sinned. And he's reading in Jeremiah that there will be a return, 70 years of captivity, and the land is resting, and then they will be called to return back to the land. So now there is this sort of, the clock starts over, and God's going to do he's going to redo history his way. So think about some of these themes again that are paralleling what we saw before. Hosea 1:10, the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of heaven. Daniel 9, 70 sevens, 490 years, are decreed for your people. Daniel 2, the stone that struck the image became a mountain and filled the whole earth. See, the geography now, we have the time. The time is a similar 400-something year period, but the geography now is really expanded. It's no longer from the Nile to the Euphrates. It's this kingdom is going to fill the entire earth. There's a new exodus in Isaiah 27. In days to come, Israel shall blossom and fill the whole world with fruit. So this is, it starts off as a small branch, and it breaks off and fills the entire world with fruit. Very similar to that theme we just saw in Daniel 2, the stone that becomes a huge mountain. Daniel 9, Jews will return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple in Daniel 9:25. And this really comes to fruition with the Edict of Cyrus. Psalm 2, we have this theme of, ask me and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. This is the ends of the earth again. The Messianic kingdom breaks the bounds of that geographical promise to Abraham, and it winds up being a new vision for the entire world being part of that kingdom. Jeremiah 33, David's greater son, we have beyond this, instead of Solomon fulfilling the Davidic role, you know, the son of David will do certain things, we have this new son of David who does something even greater in Jeremiah 33, a righteous branch. I will multiply the offspring of David like the stars and the sand. Does that sound familiar? The stars and the sand forever. But it comes from the righteous branch. It's not just, you know, this is what Jesus and John the Baptist say all the time. I can raise up children of Abraham from the rocks. There's a particular narrowing, you know, once you get to the zenith of from David and then you pare down to just one person, the Messiah himself, he's the only righteous one. This righteous branch, then, because of his righteousness is of infinite value and his blood atones infinitely, you have that being given to all those who are in him. And that's where you see the real fulfillment of the stars and the sea and the sand. Daniel 9:27, in the middle of the 70th seven, he will put an end to the sacrifice and offering. This is really interesting. So 77s is 490. That last seven is in the middle of that last seven-year period. Well, what's in the middle of seven? So math majors, half of seven is 3.5. So let's take 490 minus that last seven. That's 483. 483 years. Now, plus a few extra years here for the half. So 486 and a half. Now think about this. Did I do that right? So 490 years minus 7 is 483. Yeah, that's right. So basically, if you look at the promise here of the, where was it? 1 Kings. 480 years after the Exodus, Solomon began building the temple. 480 years after the Exodus, he began building the temple. Well, he completed the temple 7 years after he started building it, the text says. That's 487 years when the first sacrifice begins. So somewhere in here, 486 to 487, somewhere in there, is basically when sacrifice and offering stop. So Daniel says there's a 490-year period, but in that last week, that last seven, you have in the middle of that last week, there's an end to sacrifice and offering. But Solomon's promise was 487 years is when the official temple began sacrifices and offerings. That's when, so you have here something very similar is happening, but it's the ending of the temple sacrifices because the ultimate sacrifice is there and the temple is ripped. Then you have a son of man with sovereign power in Daniel 7. All peoples and nations pay this particular sovereign, this great king of kings, tribute. He is the ancient. He comes before the Ancient of Days. This, again, is a king of kings that is very different looking than a mere David or a Solomon. The beginning of the end now, get this out of your way so it makes it clear. No more math. Sorry, people. Am I saying what? Basically, there are different ways to do the chronology, and my current thinking is it's more of the 490 years is basically a mathematical way of saying the ultimate jubilee year, and so it's more of a theology than a chronology. However, the only way to make it work as a chronology is to have it not be Cyrus's edict where it starts, but the next guy, 40 or 50 years later, Artaxerxes. So there are people that try and do that. I just don't think it works as well. But if you want to try it that way, it does come out to roughly, the time Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. So basically, from the time of the edict of either Cyrus or Artaxerxes, if you have my view, you don't really need it to be a strict chronology. It's more of the promise is in the ultimate jubilee year, which is Christ, and it doesn't have to be a strict chronology. If you want it to be a chronology, you have to have it start. The clock starts with the decree, not under Ezra, but Nehemiah, I think.
Okay, so it's after
exactly.
Okay,
it's when they come back to the land, and then they begin building the temple. Mm-hmm, right.
The second temple.
Exactly, the second temple.
Gotcha.
And essentially what it's saying is they're going back into it's a new Exodus, this time an Exodus from Babylon, not Egypt. It's a new construction of the temple, and then, boom, at 487-something years, you have the end of sacrifice and offering. In Solomon's time, it was the beginning, because you had that long period and then the building of it. All right, so, now, the beginning of the end in the second time, I believe, is basically what we call the Maccabean Revolt. We'll talk about that tonight. Here, it's basically this guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes is this figure who comes in. He's a descendant of one of the guys that took over Alexander the Great's kingdom in Syria and Egypt. Antiochus Epiphanes is a very kind of antichrist figure. He actually he desolates the temple, does all kinds of bad things. We'll read about it tonight. But this is about 164, and it isn't official, right? It's a temporary thing. And the temple's restored. And this, I think, matches a lot of the stuff that's going on in the book of Daniel. This is what even Josephus argues. 164, but it's the beginning of the end, like the Assyrian crisis. At the time of the Assyrian crisis, it got to the neck, but it wasn't complete. And then the people had a little bit more time. The Assyrian crisis was in the 700s, and the Babylonian captivity was 586. And the same thing happens here. This final area, I believe, is 70 AD, when the temple is totally destroyed and razed to the ground. Same here. You had the temple destroyed with the Babylonian captivity. And here it's desolated but not destroyed. And then, but it's the beginning of the end. It's the warning. So what I want you to think about is the similarity of the second stage. This is essentially the new Assyrian crisis. And this is essentially the new Babylonian captivity. And yet, it's not another captivity. This was just the dress rehearsal for the real final thing. And this is the final thing. The problem with this is a lot of this you don't know about because it's not in our Bible. But here's the value of Josephus. Because Josephus walks through this in really good, clear detail. And if we study what's going on here, then things get to be a little bit more clear. Any comments or questions? This was a 20-minute version of what I did last time in 2 hours. So, I went pretty fast, but it's basically, I zoomed through it. All right, no questions. Good. Let's talk about Josephus. Josephus is basically a Roman name. And it is the name of a guy who was Jewish, just like Jesus is a Greek name. Jesus' real name was Joshua. Or Yeshua. But since in our Greek text, it's Yeshua turns into Jesus, we call him Jesus, and then it gets anglicized, and we call him Jesus. Well, the same thing with Josephus. Josephus was just basically Joseph. Joseph ben Matthias. I don't know why this isn't on. Wake up. There he is. I was looking at him, but you couldn't see him. So, Joseph ben Matthias would be basically be the way he would, you know, Matthias would be the father. Whenever you see Ben in a Jewish name, it's the son of, basically. So, in German, that would be von. In Dutch, it would be van. In English, it would be Johnson. Okay, so this is the way they do it in the Hebrew world. It's ben Matthias. So, this is a real bust. That's probably what it looked like. That's the fanciful, artsy way of presenting him. Josephus is a very interesting figure. He is the son of a priest. I'll read sections here where he tells his own story. He's from the priestly line. He's born in 37 AD, and he ends up writing down the history. The reason his name gets changed to Titus Flavius Josephus is he gets adopted by the conqueror of Jerusalem, Titus. Titus Flavius Vespasianus. So Vespasian and Titus, the two emperors, father, son, emperor, prince, emperor, at the time of the Jewish war. Josephus ends up being Titus's right-hand man and translator. And then at the end of it, he moves to Rome. Vespasian himself gives Josephus his old apartment when Vespasian, as the emperor, moves into the palace. So a lot of people don't know that, but that's why his name is Titus Flavius Josephus, because he's adopted, and he's basically becomes Vespasian and Titus are his patrons, and he takes on their name, and then he is given a salary to write a very, very thick book. A couple books, actually. We have his life, we have the Jewish antiquities, and we have the war, the Jewish war, and these particular books. The first one was written, was the Jewish war, probably 75 AD. Then he went over and started in the 90s. He started from the very, very beginning with the creation account, walking through the basically the sacred texts, but mining it for history rather than the sacredness of it. So we'll read this when we get to the account, maybe next week, next time we meet. Josephus actually was asked by Titus, is there anything you want? Anything you want you can have, basically. And he said, well, I'd like you to spare these guys, this guy, this guy. So he was going around people who were about to be crucified. He was saying, no, that's a friend, that's a friend. The other thing he said was, I'll take the holy books from the temple. So all the sacred scrolls. This is one of the reasons why Josephus is really helpful and handy, because he had to access all those scrolls, historical documents. There are a lot of texts, even in your Masoretic texts, there are lots of these texts like the scroll of, and it mentions a prophet, that we have seen in the King's books, but we don't actually have that scroll. There are historical books that are referenced that we don't have. Well, in this case, he is making use of historical documents that were not inscripturated, but are still history. See, if it's history, it's true, even though it's not scripture. And that's where we have to figure out. It's not inspired, and so we need to use what all the historians call the critical thinking to evaluate, is this something he's making up, or is this something that can be verified by the sources? And basically, when we look at the writings of Josephus, we find, yep, what he talked about really happened. We can dig it up. We can find the artifacts. We can find other corroborating effects and other corroborating stories. And the only warning that you have when you read Josephus is that he kind of exaggerates numbers. That's the only thing that... So even if you read someone like Tacitus, a Roman historian, talking about the same events, sometimes his numbers, in terms of the size of the army or the battle, it'll be, you know, two-thirds the size of the numbers Josephus comments. So people in his own age were aware of that. But if you read historians, they will often talk about he does exaggerate his numbers a little bit, the size of this particular city and its walls, you know, sometimes mathematically they don't work out. But generally speaking, he's a very, very careful and reliable historian as it turns to reporting events and the various details of what's going on in the various wars. All right. Let me read a couple of lines here from Josephus himself, from his autobiography. He says, I offered my books, and this is in his, what's the book that's at the beginning of the every edition of Josephus. I like this particular one, The Complete Works of Josephus, translated by William Whiston, and commentary by Paul Meyer. Paul Meyer does a very good job in studies of Josephus. All right, so he says this, I offered my books to the emperors themselves when the facts were almost under men's eyes, for I was conspicuous to myself that I had observed the truth of the facts. Moreover, immediately I presented my history to many other persons, namely some who were concerned in the war, as was King Agrippa, and some of his kindred. Now, the Emperor Titus was so desirous that the knowledge of these affairs should be taken from these books alone that he subscribed his own hand to them in order that they should be published. And for King Agrippa, he wrote me 62 letters and attested the truth of what I had therein delivered, two of which letters I have here subjoined, and so that you may know their contents. King Agrippa to Josephus, his dear friend, sendeth greetings. I have read thy book with great pleasure, and it appears to me that thou hast done it much more accurately and with greater care than have other writers. Send me the rest of these books. Farewell, my dear friend. So there you go. A letter from King Agrippa, Herod Agrippa, and then he has a second letter. King Agrippa to Josephus, dear friend. It seems by what you have written that you stand in need of no instruction in order to our in order to our information from the beginning. I must have left something out of that. However, when thou comest to me, I will inform thee of a great many things which thou dost not know. So basically, the reason I want to bring that to your attention is that here is a guy in Rome in Vespasian's apartment writing histories that are getting read by his patrons. Titus and Vespasian are interested in seeing themselves in history. King Agrippa wants to see what, you know, how did I come out? Am I a good guy? Am I a bad guy? So they're reading this, and this is not something that if you're giving a guy a lot of scrolls and a lot of time and free money to do it, that's your job, it's going to be evaluated, and he is going to have to submit this to those who know whether or not what's happening is accurate. And so also those who were in the war, various generals, you know, so he is not something he can fudge very well. Then it says, Josephus says in later in the same document, but when Titus had composed the troubles, actually, I've already talked about that. I don't need to. This is where he gives him the scrolls. So we do know that he has particular sources that are very, very, that are rare. You know, the temple was burned, but some of the scrolls he had access to before they were burned. So, all right. The Babylonian captivity is... Hello. There we go. This is Rembrandt's famous sketch. Rembrandt has a lot of great sketches. This is one of his... This is Jeremiah weeping over the destruction of Jerusalem. And this particular... captivity is 586. Now, Josephus records some things that we don't have on our Bibles about this event. Here's where we do have to ask the question. It is not scripture. And is it just Jewish fancy or in tradition, or is it really history? This we don't know, but it's interesting. In the Antiquities of the Jews, he writes this. Now, in the ninth year of the reign of Zedekiah, on the 10th day of the 10th month, the king of Babylon made a second expedition against Jerusalem and lay before it 18 months and besieged it with the utmost application. There came also upon them, as of two of the greatest calamities at the same time that Jerusalem was being besieged, a famine and a pestilential distemper, and made great havoc among them. And though the prophet Jeremiah was in prison, he did not rest but cried out, and he proclaimed aloud and exhorted the multitude to open their gates and admit the king of Babylon, for that if they did so, they should be preserved, and their whole families, but they did not do so, If they did not do so, they should be destroyed. And he foretold that if anyone stayed in the city, he should certainly perish by one of these ways, either to be consumed by famine or to be slain by the enemy's sword, but that if he would fly to the enemy, he should escape death. Yet did not these rulers who heard him believe him, and when they were in the midst of their sore calamities... Well, there you go. That was very interesting, wasn't it? All right, so basically he's telling this, he's summarizing the Babylonian captivity. The interesting thing he says is, did I have it somewhere else? Oh, here it is. All right. I'll get to that in a second. So, I'm sorry, I cut that off. I don't know what I was... Bad editing. Essentially, what we find in that account, a good summary of the Babylonian captivity, is that there is this famine and the pestilence. Those themes come up again and again during these sieges. That's also something that Jesus talks about a lot in the Olivet Discourse. Comes up a lot in the book of Revelation. I think they're connected. Josephus on the book of Daniel. So, this is another Rembrandt painting. Josephus writes that Daniel's prophecies are... He talks about the prophecies of Daniel in a very interesting way. The first thing that's interesting, as he's walking through, taking the books of Daniel as if they're history documents, he walks through the essential chronology of the book of Daniel as we have it. That's interesting because if you look at the Apocrypha, a number of the books of the Apocrypha that we have are actually additions to the book of Daniel. You may have seen like a book called Tobit or Bell and the Dragon or Susanna. These, I think all those are... pretty sure Susanna and Bell the Dragon are, I think Tobit too, are additions to the book of Daniel. So if you read those, they're like there isn't an actual dragon, but there's a story that's told by Daniel or one of his friends in that apocryphal text. So those are additions to the book of Daniel that are later additions, but in the by the time of the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, those some believe are actually part of the book of Daniel. Well, Josephus, as he's walking through the book of Daniel, doesn't include any of those weird additions, which is interesting. It shows something about what the Jews believed in 70 and 90 AD about what the actual book of Daniel looked like. In Antiquities chapter 10, or book 10, Josephus writes this, "But it is fit to give an account of what Daniel accomplished, which is most admirable to hear, for he was so happy as to have strange revelations made to him, and those as of one of the greatest of the prophets, insomuch that while he was alive, and he had those, and he had esteem and applause both of the kings and of the multitude, and he is now dead, and he retains a remembrance, and now he is dead, he retains a remembrance that will never fail. For the several books that he wrote and left behind him are still read by us to this time, and from them we will believe that Daniel conversed with God, for he did not only prophesy of future events, as did the other prophets, but he also determined the time of their accomplishment." The way they were reading it, it wasn't just a theology, it was actually a chronology. So, basically, Josephus was arguing that Daniel was predicting certain things that that came to pass along with their chronology. And while the prophets used to foretell misfortunes, and that on the account were disagreeable, both the kings and the multitude, Daniel was to them a prophet of good things, and to this such a degree by the agreeable nature of his predictions. He procured the goodwill of all men, and by the accomplishment of them, he procured the belief of their truth and the opinion of a sort of divinity for himself among the multitude. So there were a lot of people across the world. That, in fact, he even goes on to argue that in a certain place in Susa, that there was a statue to this day that remained in honor of Daniel. So there are many who argue, especially in the liberal academia, who argue that Daniel wasn't actually, he was more like a later addition that maybe only around the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, because so many of his prophecies look true in terms of writing about this kind of an event. And because of that, if you're a liberal and you don't believe in predictive prophecy, you say, well, Daniel was actually not written back then during the time of Cyrus and after that. He was written not way back here, but he was written here. Well, this is something that Josephus is not aware of. He seems to think that Daniel was old. He's got the holy books, and he believes that he was honored throughout the world. So it's possible that everybody was duped, but there's just no hint of that, that it was a later date and only a recent invention. So he then goes on to talk about the various prophecies, and this is really interesting. He says, Daniel related that when he stood up, he was shown a great ram with many horns growing out of his head, and that when it was broken off, four horns grew up that were exposed to each of the four winds. And he wrote that out of them arose another lesser horn, which, he said, waxed great, and that God showed him that it should fight against his nation and take the city by force and bring the temple worship to confusion and forbid the sacrifices to be offered for 1,296 days. Okay, so Daniel's talking about a temple desolation, and it has to do with this goat. He said that this he-goat signified that one should come and reign from the Greeks. Daniel does talk about that in Daniel 8. Who should twice fight with the Persians and overcome him in battle, and should receive his entire dominion. Basically, this is Alexander the Great. That by the great horn which sprang up from the forehead of the he-goat was meant the first king, and that the springing up of four horns upon its falling off and the conversion of every one of them to the four quarters of the earth signified the successors that should arise after the death of the first king and the partition of the kingdom among them, and that they should neither his children or its kindred that should reign over the habitable earth for many years, and that from among them there should arise a certain king that should overcome our nation and their laws, and should take away our political government, and should spoil the temple, and forbid the sacrifices to be offered for 3 years' time. And indeed, it so came to pass that our nation suffered these things under Antiochus Epiphanes. So this is interesting, because we have Josephus himself saying, writing here about 90-something, looking back to Daniel, saying it was fulfilled here. Well, that's very interesting, because it tells us, how would number one Jews interpret the book of Daniel, and then how were people Jews of the first century? Was this a common interpretation of his day? But it's if you are one of the problems I find with interpretations of the prophetic things is that many times it's just way too Gentile, and at least we should ask the question: what did other Jews think about these things? In this particular case, it was a 3.5-year period, 1,290 days. Well, that was exactly what Antiochus Epiphanes did. It was this period where he took control. He desolated the temple. We'll read a little bit about this. He sacrifices pigs on the altar, lots of bad things. And a lot of people think it's the end of the world, end of the Jewish reign. So he says, according to Daniel's vision and what he wrote many years before they came to pass. In the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government. Now it's getting really interesting. And that our country should be made desolate by them. So, there are those texts in the book of Daniel which talk about a desolation of a temple, and then, so you want to think maybe when it talks about the king of Greece fighting with the king of Persia, Daniel 8, there is this period, this what he calls an abomination of desolation, and yet there is a restoration that comes. The temple is then later restored, and it's this 3.5-year period. But there's also another abomination of desolation in which the holy people are totally cut off. And there is this line in Daniel 9 where you have this great Messiah king, the anointed one, the Messiah, who gets cut off, and then you have the prince of the people who were to come, who will make the city desolate. This is essentially the ending of Daniel 9, 26 and 27. And it sort of has this repeating pattern. First, it talks about the Messiah. Then it talks about the prince of Rome. It does it again. Messiah will confirm a covenant with many during this 1 week, that last seven. Then the city will be, then will be the abomination that makes desolate. Desolation in the city is exactly what what Josephus is saying here. Again, listen to what he says. He talked about Antiochus Epiphanes according to Daniel's vision, and he wrote about this many years before it came to pass. In the very same manner, Daniel also wrote about the Roman government and that our country would be made desolate by them. If you look at the words abomination and desolation throughout the Old Testament, it's usually in Deuteronomy, here's what's going to happen when you violate the covenant, or in the prophets, here's what's about to happen to you because you violated the covenant. That abomination and desolation language is very clear in the book of Daniel, and Jesus even alludes to it in the Olivet Discourse. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, so he's referring to something here. In Luke's version, we get a very clear picture of what that is. Because Luke translates that abomination of desolation thing in terms of when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. Well, what was that? Well, that's when the Roman armies are surrounding Jerusalem, and it all is razed to the ground and made totally desolate in 70 AD. All right, so then he says, all these things did this man leave in writing, and as God has showed them to us, inasmuch as it, as such as read his prophecies and how they have been fulfilled, many wonder how the honor of God wherewith God honored Daniel, and thence discover how the Epicureans are in error, who cast providence out of the human life and do not believe that God takes care of the affair of the world, nor that the universe is governed and continued in being by that blessed and immortal nature, but say that the world is carried along of its own accord without a ruler or curator. So basically, that sentiment is with us today. There is no ruler, there is no providence, there's only stuff that happens. And if there's only stuff that happens, then how do you explain these weird ancient books? That's got to be, well, this is what Josephus is saying, and I think is something we should say too, that prophecy is a good argument, that there is a curator of the world. There is a providence at work. And if you have, if you can show that, this is the problem with Isaiah, right? Isaiah was so clear, he names Cyrus before Cyrus is born, and that Cyrus will be the liberator. And it's so clear that most people in the scholarly world say there are two Isaiahs. Some even say there's three Isaiahs, because you can't have predictive prophecy, so there must have been a different Isaiah who wrote about the Cyrus guy in the second half of the book. That's the way it works. But that is just as dogmatic as believing in the Bible and a holy book. The dogma, there is no prophecy, there is no divinity, there is no providence, that's a dogma. It's a religious belief. So don't let people's religious belief dictate what the facts are. The question is, do those particular religious beliefs actually make sense of the data that we have? For us, we believe in inerrancy, and we say this is a doctrine. But there are those outside of that world that don't have that doctrine. Well, they have to make sense of these texts, though, as historical documents. And that's what we need to push them. How do you explain, then, these texts? All right. Antiquities 10. The head of the gold, in terms of the statue of Daniel 2. The head of the gold denotes thee, King Nebuchadnezzar, and the kings of Babylon that have been before thee. But the two hands and arms signify this, that your government shall be dissolved by two kings. But another king that shall come from the west, armed with brass, shall destroy that government. And another government shall be like unto iron, shall put an end to the power of the former, and shall have dominion over all the earth. Some of those themes that came up before as we did the summary of all of Scripture. On account of the nature of iron, which is stronger than that of gold, silver, or brass. Daniel did also declare the meaning of the stone that grew into become a whole mountain to the king. Josephus then says, but I do not think it proper to relate it, since I have only undertaken to describe things past or things present, but not things that are future. Yet if anyone be so desirous to know the truth as not to waive such points of curiosity and cannot curb his inclination for understanding the uncertainties of futurity and when they happen or not, let him be diligent in reading the book of Daniel, which he will find among the sacred writings. So this here is interesting because what he's saying is there is the succession of kingdoms, and the last kingdom, the kingdom of iron, is the last one to be defeated. So why doesn't he explain in his book that that last kingdom of iron gets shattered and then the rock becomes the mountain which fills the whole earth. Well, if he thinks of it in terms of a messianic kingdom, he doesn't want to say to all the Romans and his benefactors and that the Roman government's going to be destroyed. That's one theory. There's another theory, too, that relates to something he says that we'll talk about next time we talk about Josephus. Should I hint at it here? No, I'm not going to hint at it here. What Josephus does to the writings of Daniel is very, very interesting. And he interprets it in a way that he says again and again how much connection there is to the Roman government and the things that are happening in his own day. He says, okay. All right, so we will skip off more of that, and so we can finish up with the stuff here this evening. The Daniel portions are very, very interesting, and I wish I could spend more time on it, but we're going to wait till next week. So Josephus, when he comes to the text of Isaiah, begins talking about the reign of Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. We talked about him. Cyrus is this interesting figure who essentially takes over the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar and then essentially allows the people to go back and build their own temple. And so he is kind of this messianic figure, this great Messiah prince, this great king who is very helpful in terms of redemptive history. And we find Josephus saying this, in the first year of the reign of Cyrus, which was the 70th, from the day that our people were removed out of their own land into Babylon, God commiserated with the captivity and calamity of these poor people. Accordingly, as he had foretold them by Jeremiah the prophet before the destruction of the city, that after they had served Nebuchadnezzar and his posterity 70 years, he would restore them again into the land of their forefathers, and that they should build their temple and enjoy their ancient prosperity. And these things God did afford them, for he stirred up the mind of Cyrus and made him write this throughout all of Asia. Thus saith Cyrus, the king. This part we don't have. Since God Almighty hath appointed me to be king of the entire habitable earth, I believe that he is the God which the nations of the Israelites worship. For indeed, he foretold my name by the prophets, that I should be the one to build him a house at Jerusalem in the country of Judea. This was known to Cyrus by his reading of the book of Isaiah, left behind him by one of his prophecies. For this prophet said that God had spoken thus to him in a secret vision. Quote, my will is that Cyrus, whom I will have appointed to be king over many and great nations, shall send back my people to their own land and build my temple. This was foretold by Isaiah 140 years before the temple was demolished. Accordingly, when Cyrus read this and admired the divine power, an earnest desire and ambition seized upon him to fulfill what was so written. And he called for the most eminent Jews that were in Babylon and said to them that he gave them leave to go back to their country and rebuild their city and the temple of God. That's it. It adds an interesting dimension. If it's true, that would give an extra motivation for why Cyrus was allowed. Now, we do have this cylinder which has a number of decrees by Cyrus, and it does show that this was something he was doing generally. He did allow certain captive nations to go back to their land and rebuild various temples, so it's not an uncommon thing. We don't have a particular outside of the Bible's copy of a clay tablet which has a reference to this particular text. Yes? He basically, I mean, you have people like Daniel and others who are in Babylon who are caring for the scrolls. And so he doesn't say specifically who he got the scroll from, but he was shown by a particular Jewish caretaker in Babylon who had one of the scrolls of Isaiah, and he was shown, look, Isaiah mentioned you 150 years ago. No, Josephus does not cite, most of the time, he does not cite his sources. He doesn't cite his sources. there are occasionally, he gets a lot of information. Sometimes there are a couple of guys like Nicholas of Damascus. There are a few other places where he sorts, where he cites the source, but this particular case he doesn't. He doesn't say where he gets this information. But, again, he does have access to stuff that most of the world no longer does. So it's at least plausible that there was some kind of a historical record that showed this kind of information that we no longer have access to. So again, it's plausible, but not confirmed. Now, Alexander the Great. Josephus says, Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go to Jerusalem. So Alexander the Great is that in Daniel 8, the goat, and out of the goat's head, four horns grew, and then they go to different parts of the world. Well, after Alexander the Great dies, he conquers the world and spreads Hellenization all throughout the world, 300s B.C. After his death, at a young age of 32, his kingdom is divided between his generals. He doesn't have a successor to the throne. So those four generals, one of which, Seleucus, is the one who is in charge of the Middle East. The image you get in Daniel is this particular creature dividing into four parts is essentially what happened in the time of Alexander the Great. So he writes, Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go to Jerusalem. So did you know that Alexander went to Jerusalem? This is part of the history that we do know that he went in and went through this region because there's a city named after Alexander the Great. Anybody in here know what city that is? Alexandria. Very good. Great lighthouse, yeah, it's named after Alexander the Great. So he goes to the region of Judea, and there are people who are afraid. Well, listen to this interesting story that Josephus relates. Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, had made haste to go to Jerusalem. Now Jaddua, the high priest, when he had heard that, was in agony and under terror, and not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. He therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and join with him in offering sacrifices to God, who he besought to protect the nation and deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. They're thinking the Greeks are coming. They're going to kill us all. It's not going to be good. Whereupon, God warned this priest in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage, adorn the city, and open the gates, that the rest appear in white garments, but that he and the priests should meet the king in the habits proper to their order, without the dread of any ill consequences, which the providence of God would prevent. Upon which, he rose up from his sleep, and he greatly rejoiced and declared the warning to all that he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely, and so waited. For the coming of the king. And when he understood that he was not far from the city, he went out in procession with the priests and the multitude of the citizens. And when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans that followed him thought that they should have liberty to plunder the city and torment the high priest to death, so following Alexander the Great, which the king's displeasure fairly promised them, the very reverse of it happened. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priests stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, by the way, purple and scarlet, priestly colors, those themes come up again in, I think, the book of Revelation. So I submit that the purple and scarlet imagery, listen to this. The high priest in purple and scarlet clothing with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate upon which the name of God was engraved. Now, in the book of Revelation, this harlot is wearing purple and scarlet with something on her forehead. What's written on her forehead? Babylon the Great. It's the priestly clothing. So she's representing the harlotry of Israel's high holy people. With his mitre on his head, he approached by himself, Alexander did, and adorned that name, and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did altogether with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about, whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind. Are you crazy? However, Parmenio alone went up to him and asked how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. So everybody's bowing down to you, Alexander. Why are you bowing down to this obscure Jewish priest? To whom he replied, I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with that high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, this setup, this outfit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to take no delay but to pass over the sea thither, and that that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion of the Persians. And you know, when you think about what happens with how Daniel talks about the very succession, when you read the sacred page with the history page, they seem to match really, really well. But it's interesting to think about, if this is true, that in a dream, God is almost saying exactly what he told to Daniel, to Alexander the Great, I'm going to give you the kingdom of the Persians. I mean, you have that sort of language with God calls Darius in to conquer Nebuchadnezzar, or God calls Cyrus in to conquer Darius. And it's something God is calling. But in this particular case, what's the motivation? In this case, there is this tradition, at least, that Josephus is reporting, that there was a match between the prophecy of Daniel and Alexander's own motivation. So he has this dream of this very setting, the dream that he had, which gave him confidence to conquer the Persians, now he's seeing before his eyes. Deja vu. This is the same people, and they're in the same getup. And when the book of Daniel was shown to him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that he himself was the person intended, and as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present, but the next day he called them to him and bade them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute on the seventh year, the year of Jubilee, that they can leave their farms and not do any taxation. He granted all that they desired, and when they entreated him that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Media to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired. So they get special treatment from Alexander because he was honoring them, and this is true. We do know that the Jews were allowed, until the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, to continue their sort of strange Jewish customs. And at that time, then they are told, you cannot circumcise, you cannot obey these particular laws, you have to be Hellenized, you can even look at coinage from this period on, and even the coinage of the rulers in Judea are, you know, Greek characters. All righty. Any comments, questions? Interesting? Yeah. All right. Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes, this guy here. Lots of interesting information about this particular time. This is the time known as the Maccabean Revolt. We know it as the Hanukkah story. So this is the time Judah Maccabees comes and they are defending the temple. And so there's this period of lots of problems in the realm of Judea. And this is a great conflict. So Josephus writes about it quite a lot. And I want to read you a couple paragraphs. In Antiquities 12, at this time Seleucus, who was called Soter, reigned over Asia, being the son of Antiochus the Great. Antiochus the Great is the father of Antiochus Epiphanes. But when he was dead, his brother Antiochus, who was called Epiphanes, took the kingdom. His brother, son of Antiochus. Okay, so when Antiochus the Great, so I guess Antiochus isn't his son, it's his brother. About this time, about 164-ish, 167 to 64-ish. Upon the death of Onias the high priest, they gave the high priesthood to Jesus, his brother. But this Jesus was deprived of the high priesthood by the king, who was angry with him, and gave it to his younger brother, Menelaus. Now, as the former high priest, Jesus, who ends up changing his name to Jason, this is interesting because there is this sort of new emphasis in having a Greek identity, that actually continues on throughout. If you look at the names in of the high priests in the time of Jesus, there are names like Theophilus or other very Greek-sounding names. Now he says, this Jesus, who is now Jason, raised a sedition against Menelaus. Menelaus is a very Greek name, who was ordained after him. The multitude were divided between these two people. But the greater part of the people assisted Jason, and by that means Menelaus, the son of and the sons of Tobias, were distressed and retired to Antiochus Epiphanes, who informed him that they were desirous to leave the laws of their country and the Jewish way of living according to them, to follow the king's laws and the Grecian way of living. So in a lot of people don't know this. They just think of, in terms of Antiochus Epiphanes, he's invading the country. Well, there's a squabble in the land, and this is a theme that comes up again and again. The people in Israel are squabbling, and they go to him for help, and one of them says, help us, come settle this matter for us. We'll even follow your laws and give up our strange Jewish laws. Now, think about that as we just did the summary of are you living holy in this holy land? Are you following the laws, or are you being like the Amorites? So, wherefore they desired his permission to build them a gymnasium at Jerusalem. And when he had given them leave, they also hid their own circumcision. There's a surgical thing. And that even when they were naked, they might appear to be Greek. Accordingly, they left off all the circumcisions that belonged to their own country and imitated the practices of other nations. So they're being like the Amorites. Antiquities 12:246. King Antiochus returned out of Egypt for fear of the Romans. This is the first hint we get that the Romans are beginning to raise in power. Made an expedition against the city, and when he was there, in the 143rd year of the kingdom of the Seleucids, he took the city without fighting, those of his own party opening the gates to him. So he is taking Jerusalem without people who are, wanting to be like the Greeks. They're opening the gates of Jerusalem to this Antichrist figure. When he had gotten possession of Jerusalem, he slew many of the opposing party. He left the temple bare and took away the golden candlesticks, the golden altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the altar of burnt offering, and did not abstain from even the veils, which were made of fine linen, and scarlet. Scarlet's another one of these colors that comes up in Revelation. He also emptied it of its secret treasures and left nothing at all remaining, and by this means cast the Jews into great lamentation. For he forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices which they used to offer God according to their law. And when he had pillaged the whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew, and some he carried captive together with their wives and children, so that the multitude of those captives were taken alive amounted to about 10,000. And when the king had built an altar upon God's altar, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law or the Jewish religious worship in that country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which they paid to their own God, and to adore those whom he took to be gods, and made themselves build temples. And this is one of those things that the kings throughout the Old Testament, Kings and Chronicles, are always being condemned because they didn't destroy the high altars. Well, he's building a lot of high altars. He also commanded them not to circumcise their sons, and to threaten to punish any that should be found to have transgressed his injunction. He appointed overseers who should compel them to do what he commanded. And indeed, many Jews there who were complied with the king's command, either voluntarily or out of fear of the penalty that was denounced. But the best men and those of the noblest souls did not regard him, but did pay a greater respect to the customs of their country than concern as to the punishment which he threatened to the disobedient, on which the account they every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments. Persecution. Essentially, a lot of slaughtering of Jews who were faithful. They continued to do their practices. They continued to do what was right. And because of it, especially on the Sabbath day when they don't take up arms, they were slaughtered. For they were whipped with rods and their bodies were torn to pieces and were crucified. See, crucifixion is now one of the things that's now on the stage as something that's happening regularly, capital punishment. They were crucified while they were still alive and breathed, and they also strangled those women and their sons whom they had crucified as the king had appointed, and hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon their crosses. And if there were any sacred books of the law found, it was destroyed, and those with whom they were found miserably perished also. And this is one of those times which like in this era here, when you have this sort of thing happening with Roman power, there are those who were hiding some of the sacred scrolls, which, you know, we know them, a lot of those kinds of hidden scrolls as the Dead Sea Scrolls. This was happening here too. People were, you know, they were burning scrolls, and not all were burned because we still have the basis for the Masoretic Scrolls. All right, so now it starts to get really interesting because we make the transition here from the time of Antiochus Epiphanes to this time of total destruction and the time of Jesus before that. So, see if we can get it all in here. For so it was that the temple was made desolate by Antiochus. That desolation language is something that Daniel used and that Josephus uses. Again, I find Josephus very helpful in terms of interpreting some of the big picture. There are subtle issues of interpretation that you look at 100 commentators and you get 100 different answers, but there are these big epochal moments in the history of Israel, and Josephus is very helpful in terms of at least giving us a picture of what Jews thought about how this was accomplished. And there are a lot of people today who still think that what Daniel's talking about, Daniel 8 and other parts, is still yet to come. And so I just think that I think there's a good answer here for us. For it was so that the temple was made desolate by Antiochus, and so continued for 3 years. And this desolation came to pass according to the prophecy of Daniel, which was given 480 years before he declared that the Macedonians would dissolve that worship for some time. Now Judas celebrated the festival of the restoration after the Maccabean revolt happens and they cleanse the temple. Now there is a celebration of that event, and then he says, this festival of restoration lasted 8 days and omitted no sort of pleasures thereupon, but he feasted upon them and had sacrificed splendid sacrifices, and he honored God and delighted with hymns and psalms, and therefore they made it a celebration that was decreed to be celebrated annually. It became known as the Festival of Lights, which we today know as Hanukkah. But that Festival of Lights, when you find it in the New Testament, there's one scene where Jesus is going up to celebrate the Festival of Lights. That's essentially the commemoration of this event, when the temple was desolated, and then during this three-year period. But again, it's desolated, and it's almost, Judaism is almost done away with, just like the time of the Assyrian crisis, and yet there's this miraculous restoration, but it's signaling the beginning of the end. The end of the age is near. Now, the Maccabean family, this is the problem again and again and again. You have basically everybody on the ark was a Christian, right? Now, they repopulated the earth. How's it going for us? Everybody in Jerusalem is their followers of Yahweh at the time of the Exodus. And how'd it go for them? It didn't go up, right? The problem isn't just the world out there. The problem is us. I think it's the big lesson here, right? So the Maccabees have the control of the kingdom, and here's what happens after the Maccabees, one problem after another. The Maccabean family is also known as the Hasmoneans. The Hasmoneans, I think, would be the first Maccabee is Matthias, and his sons are Judas, Simon, and Jonathan. Judah Maccabee is the most famous of them. But his father's name is Matthias. I think Matthias' father was Hasmoneus, and that's why it's called the Hasmonean dynasty. We know them as the Maccabees because the word Maccabee means hammer, and they were just a strong force, so that's kind of like their nickname. It wasn't an official last name. So, Judah Maccabee dies in this conflict. This is sometime around, the whole conflict was 167 BC to 160. The main time of the temple being desolated was maybe 164 to 160. During that time, 160-ish, somewhere in there, Judah dies. So, but they actually win the revolt, and his Simon ends up becoming the leader of the ruler in Jerusalem. Let's find him. I missed Antiochus Epiphanes. Before we move on, Antiochus Epiphanes, here's a coin which has his figure. And in Greek below it, it says, King Antiochus, the divine made manifest, bringer of victory. So, epiphanies, you know, if somebody has an epiphany, that's basically manifestation. So the divine made manifest is his nickname. That's why it's Antiochus Epiphanes. And that's right there on his coin. So this is why I believe he is the one of the little horns. There are two little horns in the writings of Daniel. I think he's one of them. He's a little horn, which is a king that speaks boastfully, and this is part of the boastful speech. The Maccabean Revolt, 167 to 160. Now, Simon has a couple sons. The first son is John Hyrcanus, the first. He ruled from 134 to 104 BC. These drawings are from a 1500s medieval book who either was being fanciful or actually had coins that we no longer have. So make them what you will. So he is, this guy, John Hyrcanus, was the son of Simon, who himself was one of the brothers of the Maccabean family. He rules from 134 to 104 BC and was disliked by the Pharisees. The Pharisees, if you want a really good book on this particular topic here, get my book. Fantastic book, just for the introductory material. The Dead Sea Scrolls by Michael Wise is the main editor. There are a lot of different theories about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it covers a lot of this time in here. But in particular, one of the things he points out is that the Pharisees and the Sadducees kind of switched places. So there was a time in which, like when you get the New Testament period, the Sadducees are the liberals and the Pharisees are more conservative. But back here, when these scrolls are being written, the Pharisees are slightly more liberal, and the Sadducees are the more conservative ones. Sadducee itself means of the tribe of the high priestly family of Zadok, and so it was like, you know, Zadok was one of the high priests at the time of David. So it's supposed to be authentic priestliness. All right, so this is interesting. One Pharisee in particular asked Hyrcanus to resign the high priesthood and to retain only the civil government. Here is a time, Josephus is saying, when after the Maccabean period, it was essentially those who took the power to stave off this Antiochus Epiphanes, this Greek incursion. Well, now it's basically you get to reign because you were a military force and you get to do it. Now you get to be the high priest and the king. Now things are interesting, right? We have a priest king. That hadn't happened for a while in the history of Israel. In fact, there were times when this prophet, priest, king expectation, so there may be people thinking this is messianic. This particular Pharisee doesn't like it. He says he wants him to give up to resign as high priest and to retain only the civil government. When he asked why, this man said, "We have heard it from old men that your mother had been a captive under the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes." What's he saying? Maybe you are a bastard. Basically, is what he's saying. And you may have Greek DNA. Hyrcanus was furious and was influenced by a friend to leave the party of the Pharisees and to entertain the doctrines of the Sadducees. This is one of those times where you don't want to think Sadducee as being liberal. You want to think of the Sadducees as being an alternative party, but at this point they were bitter, bitter enemies. According to Josephus, he then abolished the decrees that the Pharisees had imposed on the people and punished those that observed them. From this source arose the hatred which he and his sons met with the multitude. Josephus goes on to explain that the Pharisees had delivered to the people a great many observances by succession from their fathers, which are not written in the laws of Moses. See, this is where the Sadducees are, at this time, more like what Jesus was saying. Jesus was criticizing the Pharisees in the New Testament period for adding all this stuff. Well, the Sadducees were the more conservative party, and looking at all the additions and traditions of the Pharisees and saying that's not faithful to classical Judaism. And for that reason, that the Sadducees reject them and say that we are to esteem those observances that are obligatory, which are written in the Word only, sola scriptura, but are not to observe what are derived from the traditions of our forefathers. Interesting, isn't it? Josephus concludes that Hyrcanus was esteemed by God worthy of three of the greatest privileges: the government of his nation, the dignity of the high priesthood, and even prophecy. Prophet, priest, king. Isn't it interesting? He says, "For God was with him and enabled him to know the future even, and to foretell this in particular, that as two of his oldest sons, he foretold that they would not long continue in the government of public affairs." Later, Josephus relates a dream that Hyrcanus has, in which he sees the images of his two eldest sons and inquires of them which shall be king, at which time an image of his younger son, Alexander, appears. His younger son, Alexander, who he dislikes. This is Aristobulus, who is his brother, the brother of Hyrcanus, who, actually it's his son, I believe. Let me think here. Hyrcanus dies in 104, which is approximately 200 years before. Okay, I'll get to that. After the death of Hyrcanus, his eldest son, Aristobulus, takes the throne. This is one of the two sons that dies, right? So he gets this dream that that they won't be long on the throne. And this is actually what happens. Alexander Janaeus says, this is the son who, the other image of the son who comes up. He winds up being kind of a wicked character. We'll talk about him in just a second. So Josephus concludes, he says, Hyrcanus the First dies in 104 BC, which is approximately 200 years before Josephus writes his book, The Antiquities of the Jews. And in his description of the breastplate of the priests wore, which had the Ummim and the Thummim, he says, "For as to the stones which the high priest bare on his shoulders, the one of them shone out when God was present at their sacrifices. I mean that which was in the nature of a button on his right shoulder. Bright rays would dart out thence, and being seen by, even by those that were the most remote, far away, which splendor was not yet natural to that stone. God also, according to the historian, declared beforehand by those 12 stones which the high priest bare on his breastplate, and which were inserted into his plate, when they would be victorious in battle. For so great a splendor shone forth from them before the army began to march, that all the people were sensible of God's being present before their assistance. Now this breastplate and this stone left off shining 200 years before I composed this book, God having been displeased at the transgression of his law." Josephus is saying something started to change. Now we know this also from the Old Testament, the writings of the prophets stop. We no longer, God isn't speaking to his people anymore, and there's this long silence. That's why we have an intertestamental period. But Josephus is saying there's a tradition in the Jews that even those small miraculous things that you saw in the Old Testament with Moses, the shining stone which gave direction, there was a record of that having stopped 200 years before. Well, that corresponds to what we had here with Hyrcanus, this descendant of Judah Maccabees. And that guy was a prophet, priest, king character. Josephus calls him just. He did some reforms, getting rid of, kind of similar to what Jesus did, getting rid of some of the additions to the Mosaic law. And this is a period, I will submit, is also something we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We're now in the realm where we're starting to find scrolls that match this emphasis. We'll talk about that a little bit too here. All right, so we have the death of Hyrcanus. His eldest son, Aristobulus, takes the throne. This is Aristobulus the First. He put his mother in prison and begins to starve her to death, for she was appointed to be queen by Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus was going to have his wife take over, but he didn't like it, so, mom, you go to jail. And no food for you. He also had his other brother, next in line, killed, which is, according to Josephus, he had his brother Antigonus killed, who was next in line, which according to Josephus was prophesied by a man named Judas from the sect of the Essenes. The sect of the Essenes may be the people who were collecting the Dead Sea Scrolls. Aristobulus died soon after that of an intestinal disorder, and which he believed to be God's judgment upon the slaughter of his relations. Aristobulus reigned for 1 year, from 104 to 103. Hyrcanus' younger son, Alexander Janneus, the one he disliked and he got the image of later that he would rule, assumes the throne in 103 and was foretold, as Hyrcanus was foretold in the dream. Under the name King Yanni, this particular guy appears in the Talmud as the wicked tyrant. So King Yanni, the wicked tyrant, is essentially this character who appears in the Talmud here and there. The writers of the Talmud don't like this guy. However, he also may be the wicked priest of the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are debates about this. He also may be one of the guys who is beloved by the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because at this time, it depends on your position. Are you more a Sadducee or are you a Pharisee? And this wasn't just a doctrinal dispute. This was a blood feud. And as we'll see, it gets bloody. And all this background information gets really, really helpful as we get into the New Testament period, because all this is sort of under the skin, that it's kind of like growing up in a family where there was a big family feud before you were born. You don't understand what's going on, but why don't you say that to Grandmama? Shh, just don't talk about that. There's a lot of, shh, don't talk about that, buried here, but you find out in Josephus what they were talking about. So King Alexander Janneus is one of the king. Josephus relates the following story concerning this guy. As to Alexander, his own people were seditious against him. For at a festival, which was then celebrated, when he stood upon the altar in Jerusalem at the temple, he committed some kind of sacrilege. The nation rose up upon him then and began throwing things at him. And they reviled at him as derived from a captive and so unworthy of his dignity of sacrificing. At this time he was in a rage and slew out of them about six. He slew 6,000 of them at the temple. He also built a partition wall of wood around the altar and the temple, as far as that partition within which it was only lawful for the priest to enter, and by this means he obstructed the multitude from coming at him. So he has his men barricaded in the holiest part of the sanctuary. He commits some kind of sacrilege. He is doing some, and then he's using the holy places as his place of refuge. Some time passes, and he enters into a number of other battles with neighboring nations. He fled once again to Jerusalem, where, besides his other ill successes, the nation insulted him, and fought against them for 6 years, and slew no fewer than 50,000 of them. The Jews continued to fight against Alexander, and being beaten, were slain in great numbers in the several battles which they had, and which, when he had captured most of the powerful men of them, he brought them to Jerusalem, and did one of the most barbarous actions in the world, says Josephus. For as he was feasting with his concubines, this is the king of Israel, people. Is he more righteous than the Amorites? When he was feasting with his concubines in the sight of all the city, he ordered about 800 of these men to be crucified. Think about a picture of that as a picture of Jerusalem about 100 years before Jesus. And while they were living, he ordered their throats of their children and wives to be cut before their eyes. So they are being crucified, but before they're dead, he's slaughtering their family members. There's a good picture for you for Alexander Janneus. All right, so now, the Dead Sea Scrolls, section cave 4, 169, is this commentary on Nahum that is very, very interesting. It has a lot of this information. It's interpreting Nahum as if it was applying for the day. It's allegorical in its interpretation, but there are some of these themes that come up, and many of the writers talk about this particular Dead Sea Scroll as being written in this context where you have the various factions during this time being alluded to, and it's pretty clear that they're right, but I don't have the time to go into it, so I will let you read Dead Sea Scrolls 4Q169 on your own. Queen Salome Alexandra, so this is his wife here, she reigns from 76 to 67. When she when this wicked king dies, he actually finds, he says, Josephus says this, King Alexander fell into a distemper by hard drinking. So I guess it was liver problems, maybe? When his queen saw that he was ready to die and had no longer any hopes of surviving, she came to him weeping and lamenting and bewailed herself and her sons on the desolate condition they should be left in, and said to him, "To whom thou dost thou leave me and my children, who are destitute of all other support? And this when thou knowest how much ill will thy nation bears thee." But he gave her the following advice, that she needed to follow what he would suggest to her in order to retain the kingdom securely. With her children, that she should conceal his death from their soldiers until she should have taken that place. After this, she should go in triumph, as upon a victory, to Jerusalem, and put some of her authority into the hands of the opposing party, that of the Pharisees, for that they would commend her for the honor she had done them, and would reconcile the nation to her, for he told her that they had great authority among the Jews then, both to do hurt and such as they hated, and to bring advantages to those whom they were friendly disposed. In other words, it was about power. So she does this. She actually converts to the party of the Pharisees, and she then says, Josephus, "So Alexandria acted as her husband suggested, and spake to the Pharisees, and put all things into their power as the affairs of the kingdom, and thereby pacified their anger against Alexander. When they came among the multitude, they laid before them the actions of Alexander, and told them that they had lost a righteous king, and that by their condemnation, by their commendation, they brought them to grieve to the people, the multitudes, and to be in heaviness for him upon his death, so that he had a funeral more splendid than any of the kings before him had. Alexander, then, was loved by the multitude." War. Now, she goes to be with the Pharisee party, and the Pharisees join themselves to Salome Alexandra to assist her in the government. She is 76 to 67. "These are a certain sect of the Jews that appear more religious than others," Josephus says. They appear more religious. "But these Pharisees artfully insinuated themselves into her favor little by little and became themselves the real administrators of the public affairs. They banished and reduced whom they pleased. They bound and loosed men at their pleasure." Does that language sound familiar to the New Testament? Binding and loosing? Okay, so this is you imprison or you let out of prison, essentially. And Jesus uses that for heavenly things. "And to say all at once, they had enjoyment of the royal authority, whilst the expense and the difficulties of it belonged to Alexandra. While she governed other people, and the Pharisees governed her, they also prevailed with Alexandra to put to death those who had been against them, and accordingly they slew whomever they pleased." So this is a violent time. You got to think in terms of this being a political party that has the power of the sword. Comment? The Greeks are out of here now. Once you had this particular event here, the Greeks are no longer a tributary nation to anyone. They are now their own nation state, and it's basically run by the priesthood family of the Hasmoneans. They become priest kings, but it's a small kingdom, right? But they are their own people. But this is about to change. Rome is coming, and why it comes is very interesting. So they were putting to death those who they pleased, but the principal of those that were in danger fled to Aristobulus, her younger son, who persuaded his mother to spare the men on the account of their dignity, but to expel them out of the city. So they were dispersed all over the country. So this younger son, Aristobulus, is basically saying, look, don't kill them, just evict them, exile them. Well, this is basically how we get the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you look at their language, it's all about eviction. There are wicked priests in control. We are a holy community away from the evils of the, not just the world in general, but the world of the Jews. And they were going to live as a holy community separate from all that because of the wickedness that had been going on. And sometimes it's written from the perspective of a Sadducee, a holy Sadducee, and other times it's written from the perspective of a Pharisee. There are some documents that can be interpreted in different ways. All right. So, in the meantime, 67 BC-ish or so, Alexandra falls sick, and Aristobulus, her younger son, took hold of the opportunity and got possession of all her fortresses. Here are the two sons of Salome Alexandra. Oldest son, younger son. Aristobulus, her younger son, took hold of an opportunity when she's sick and gets hold, takes possession of the fortresses. He also uses money that he finds in those fortresses to gather together a number of mercenaries, and he makes himself king. Besides upon this, Hyrcanus complains to his mother, and she compassionated his case and put Aristobulus' wife and sons in prison. But Alexandra died before she could punish Aristobulus for his disinheriting his brother after she had reigned 9 years. This leads to a full-out civil war between these two boys. The king of Arabia joins the forces with Hyrcanus and begins to make an assault upon Jerusalem, where the forces of Aristobulus have fled. They make camp inside the walls of the temple grounds. The people were in support of Hyrcanus, and none but the priests were in support of Aristobulus. So Aristobulus still has that sort of a Sadducean priestly background, but the populace, the Pharisees, had the people. This is why Salome went with the Pharisee party, so she could win the heart of the people. During this time, at the Feast of Passover, the principal men among the Jews left the country. So this is a time of outright civil war. People are leaving town, it's a time of huge conflict. Now there was one whose name was Onias, a righteous man, and he was beloved of God, who in a certain drought had prayed to God to put an end to the intense heat, and whose prayers God had heard and had sent them rain. This man himself had hid, because he saw that sedition would last a great while. However, they brought him to the Jewish camp and desired that he, by his prayers, since he got rid of the drought, maybe he could get rid of this war. And when upon his refusal, at the excuses that he made, he was still by the multitude compelled to speak. And he stood upon in the midst of them and said, O God, the King of the whole world, since those that stand now with me are thy people, and those that are besieging are also thy priests, I beseech thee, that thou wilt neither hearken to the prayers of those against thee, nor bring to effect what these pray against those. Whereupon such wicked Jews as stood about him, and as soon as he had made this prayer, they stoned him to death. He's basically saying, these are your people here, and these are your people there, so don't answer either of their prayers. And, we don't like that answer. Boom! This is the story. So this particular tale is what's going on again. Now we are just a generation before, a little more than a generation before the time of Christ. All right. We're almost wrapping up here. He says, the civil war continues for a few years, and when the Roman general Pompey, it's a pretty good bust. He looks like an actor. What was the name of the actor he looks like, Heidi? Famous actor. His name escaped me. Harvey Keitel. He kind of looks like Harvey Keitel. The civil war continues for a few years, and when the Roman general Pompey is nearby in a nearby country, both brothers, these two guys right here, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, the names get confusing because there are a couple Hyrcanuses and a couple Aristobuluses, they are both trying to get Pompey, the Roman general, to settle their dispute. Pompey sides with Hyrcanus eventually, the older, and marches against Jerusalem. Frightened, Aristobulus came to meet Pompey. Actually, his name is pronounced Pompey. They came to meet Pompey and offered him bribes and other promises. He ended up being taken into custody, but the forces in Jerusalem continued to fight. Josephus. Now, as he was long in deliberating about this matter, a sedition arose among the people in the city. Aristobulus' party being willing to fight and to set their king free, while those of the party of Hyrcanus were for opening the gate of Pompey, and the dread of the people were in occasioned these last to be a very numerous party when they looked upon the excellent order of the Roman soldiers. So Aristobulus's party was worsened and retired into the temple and cut off the communication between the temple and the city by breaking down the bridge that joined them together, and prepared to make an opposition to the utmost. But as the others had received the Romans into the city and had delivered up the palace to him, Pompey sent one of his officers into the palace with an army. It was in the third month of the siege, before the Romans could even, with great difficulty, overthrow one of the towers and get into the temple. So this is 63 BC by the time this happened. So look at the dates here. 66, he starts to be king, and then he stops. This guy takes over to 63. But by 63, Pompey is taking control of the situation. This guy then becomes king again until 40 BC. And this siege of the temple by Pompey, this is how the Romans come into the land. He was asked to settle this dispute between these two squabbling Jewish boys. That's how Rome comes into the picture. Rome takes over and then makes you guys settle down. We'll figure this out. And now it's back to being a client state of a larger empire. It was in the third month of the siege before the Romans could even with great difficulty overthrow one of the towers. Pompey could not but admire not only at the other instances of the Jews' fortitude, but especially that they did not at all intermit their religious services, even while they were encompassed with darts on all sides. For, as if the city were in full peace, their daily sacrifices and purifications and every branch of their religious worship were still performed to God with utmost exactness. Nor indeed, when the temple was actually taken, were they every day slain about the altar, did they leave off their instances of their divine worship that were appointed by their law. The greatest part of them were slain by their own countrymen of the adverse faction. That's the part, that's the line that just gets you in the gut. They're killing each other. Sadducee versus Pharisee. And Pompey is there to sort of put this skirmish down. And an innumerable multitude threw themselves down the precipices. Of the Jews that were slain, 12,000, there were 12,000 slain, but of the Romans, very few. But a greater number was wounded. Okay, wrapping things up, but there was nothing that affected the nation so much as the calamities that were then under, as their holy place, which had hitherto been seen by none, should be laid open to strangers. For Pompey and those that were about him went into the temple itself, where it was not lawful for anyone to enter but the high priest. And he saw what was repositioned therein. Yet did not he touch the sacred money or artifacts. But he commended the ministers about the temple the very next day, and after he had taken it, to cleanse it and to perform their accustomed sacrifices. Moreover, he then made Hyrcanus high priest and client king of Rome. So he's established here. So Pompey is kind of doing what Titus does later, before it's this calm before the storm. He enters into the Holy of Holies, and yet nothing happens. You know, there were times in the Old Testament history where the Ark of the Covenant goes into the Philistines, and then all these diseases happen, and they're like, here, you take it, and we don't like this. Well, that doesn't happen here. It's almost like what Josephus is saying, is the miraculous is sort of fizzled out. God has given up. There aren't any more miracles. The people are wicked, and he's letting them, the sins mount to be, the sin of the Amorites is reaching its full measure, essentially. All right. Josephus comments now, the occasion of this misery which came upon Jerusalem were Hyrcanus and Aristobulus by raising a sedition one against the other. For now we lost our liberty and became subjects to the Romans and were deprived of our own country. Moreover, the Romans exacted of us in little time above 10,000 talents and the royal authority, which was a dignity formerly bestowed on that which were the high priests. By the right of their family, that became the right of private men. So now Rome appoints governors like Pontius Pilate. Rome appoints the high priests. Not Jerusalem. See, that sounds weird to us that a secular state would do that, but it wasn't a secular state. They had high priests in Rome as well. That was a very political office. So this is how things get... this is why, again, 48 BC. 49 BC is a very important year. Involves Julius Caesar. 49, Caesar crosses something called a Rubicon. And he is basically... bringing his forces into Rome and threatening Pompey and his men. So now there was peace between Pompey and Caesar, and now Caesar is saying, I'm going to... And he was, when he crossed the Rubicon, came into Rome, Pompey's forces fled. He was then decreed the perpetual dictator of Rome. Not emperor, but perpetual dictator. So then they end up fighting. A couple notes here about Caesar, and then we're all done. Pompey orders his forces to evacuate Rome by summer of 48. Pompey and Caesar meet up at the Battle of Pharsalus in central Greece. Caesar was outnumbered 2-1, but in the end he ended up winning the battle, and Pompey ends up fleeing to Egypt. During the siege of Alexandria in 48-47, Pompey is defeated by Caesar's forces. According to one historian, boxed in at Alexandria by a large force of hostile Egyptians, Caesar was rescued by the cavalry of one man named Antipater. He is not the opposite of Harry Potter. That was Sydney's guess. There's Harry Potter and there's his opposite, Antipater. No, different man. By the cavalry of Antipater, the Idumean. Idumean would be someone from Edom. The cavalry of Antipater, the Idumean chieftain, and his ally, Hyrcanus II. Hyrcanus was rewarded with the ethnarchy of the Jews. So this is this particular Hyrcanus. He was there helping during this battle of Caesar. There was a particular time when Caesar, Pompey had already been defeated, but he was still waging certain battles in Egypt, and they came to his aid, and he was very thankful for their services, both Hyrcanus and this guy, Antipater. Hyrcanus was rewarded the ethnarchy of the Jews. See, this time he was initially just a high priest, but now he's given certain territories. And then it also led Caesar to give the Jewish people special rights and privileges throughout the Mediterranean world. Because he assisted, he then was giving, kind of like we saw before, you had certain, like out with Alexander the Great, Caesar was called friend of the Jews for many, many years. There were a lot of people, Jewish people in Rome at Caesar's funeral. He made a lot of laws which allowed Jews to opt out of pagan worship, which was certain, you know, you had to, if you want to go to the marketplaces, you had to pinch an inch to Caesar, pinch some incense. So he says, Jews would also be excused from conscription to military service because of what Hyrcanus did. Antipater was also, the Idumean, was appointed procurator of all Judea. Basically, he's the new Pontius Pilate, but before there was a Pontius Pilate, he's the first guy. His oldest son, Faisal, was appointed governor of Jerusalem, basically a mayor, and his younger son, anybody know his younger son's name? The son of Antipater? Herod. Herod is basically the son of Pontius the Pilate. Pontius Pilate. Antipater, the first one in that office. Herod is the son of an Idumean. He's basically one of these guys that's not Jewish, but one of these people who's from the tributary nation states who's going to help Julius Caesar. And then his sons, Faisal and Herod, end up getting certain things. Now, Herod, at age 25 in 49 B.C., at age 25, gets the territory of Galilee. Only a couple years later, Faisal ends up dying, and Herod gets more. Here's what happens. A nephew of Hyrcanus, by the time of Antigonus, attempts to seize the throne with the help of the Parthians, whom he made an alliance. Herod, Faisal, and Hyrcanus, for a number of years, are involved with various skirmishes to fight off this particular threat. Faisal is captured and killed, and Herod then loots the temple in an attempt to bribe Mark Antony to have him come take his side. So here, Mark Antony, lots of money, please side with me. According to Josephus, and this is the last thing we'll end with tonight, because Herod offered money and because of his hatred to Antigonus, an enemy to the Romans, Julius Caesar raised Herod's dignity and gave him his assistance in what he desired on account of the toils of war which he had himself undergone with Antipater, his father, in Egypt, and also to gratify Antony, who was very zealous for Herod. Upon this, the Senate was irritated, and Antony informed of them farther that it was for their advantage in the Parthian War that Herod should be king. This seemed good to all the senators, and so they made a decree accordingly. When the Senate was dissolved, Antony and Caesar went out of the Senate house, with Herod in between the two, and with the consuls and other magistrates before them, in order to offer sacrifices to lay up their decrees in the capital. Antony also feasted Herod the first days of his reign, and thus did this man receive the kingdom. That language sound familiar to the New Testament? Thus did this man receive the kingdom, having obtained it on the 184th Olympiad, when Caius Dominus Calvinus was the consul the second time. So here we have this picture of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, and between them, Herod the Great. In Rome, Herod receives the kingdom. Why? Well, it's just favors and money and bribes. This is how we get the guy who is the king, when Jesus is born. Interesting story? When you see all that happens here with the struggling and the conflict, you say, wow, there's a reason why another part of the world has the Davidic throne. These other kingdoms are called in to kick out the Jews and to squash again and again, with the Babylonians, with the Assyrians, with the Greeks, with the Romans, and all this in great detail is prophesied by Daniel himself. But this time it's making Israel fewer and fewer, not like the stars of heaven, but fewer and fewer, down to one particular grain of sand, this one child born of Joseph and Mary. Then the kingdom that is not of this world takes a different route, and that's the one we know of as Christians. So next time when we meet and we talk, which will be August 1st, we're going to start here with Herod, and then talk about a lot of the stuff that happens from here until 70 AD, because there's some very interesting stuff that happens that I think fleshes out a lot of the things that that are talked about in the New Testament, especially that not one stone will be left upon another, etc. So, any thoughts, comments before we close? We went a little long, but I had to get through a lot of material. So hope you enjoyed it, and next time we'll talk about Josephus Part 2.